Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
All right, Gary.
How you doing, Guy? How's everything with you? How's your week been?
It's been, you know, like every other week. Just down here, you know, daily prescribed exercise and the odd trip to the shops.
I can see you've got the Taurus bass pedals out in the background.
I have.
But they make...
Well, that's because I'm going to have to start learning how to use them in case we actually go on tour.
Yeah, absolutely. And to explain what they are, what do they do?
Taurus bass pedals. They're the proggiest of prog accoutrements, aren't they? They're when the bass player is so busy that he's got to actually play the bass with his feet because he's playing mandolin or a 12-string or something.
John Paul Jones plays them.
John Paul Jones, everyone had them. They were, and it's, they're a nightmare. Let's be honest. I mean, anyway, you can't be, because obviously, I mean, you can't be flash or anything because you've got to stand up at the same time. But anyway, but actually we're going for something, we're going in a more traditional direction today, aren't we? With our fabulous Irish artist we're speaking to.
Yeah, who's brought out two albums since lockdown, or an album of poetry that was amazing. And I mean, she's a really fantastic person.
A powerful voice. She's a very powerful voice. I mean, in every regard.
So let's get her on.
Welcome to Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
This was great, guys. It's so great to talk to two guys that have done this.
Well, it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
You know, what people forget about Bowie is that he was such a kind man.
Remember me? I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah. To
get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Very good.
Are you well?
I'm well. I can't speak for Gary.
I am. I'm finding it all a bit still stressful. Can't wait to be out the other end properly. But Guy and I have had our jabs.
Oh, good. You're free.
We're free. Where are you, Imelda?
I'm in Hampshire.
Oh, Hampshire.
Not that far from me. I'm in Sussex. So it's down the road.
Okay. That's not far at all. This is where I live. But I was, because I had this with you this morning, I was pretty good last night considering it was St. Patrick's night. I thought I'd better.
Oh, of course. Oh, God. We should have thought. I'm so sorry.
Did we
grab St. Patrick's?
This could have been way more difficult than it is.
Oh, yeah. Like a few years ago, it would have been you. Ronnie would have still been there, right?
It was a good one. We did an online gig just for fun in the kitchen.
Oh, I saw a bit of it on Instagram, yeah.
Yeah, it was just me and my boyfriend and the dog and a few friends zooming in. It was nice. It's just simple. It's just filming what we'd be doing anyway. But yeah, it was good.
How often do you get to go back to Ireland?
Well, normally I go every couple of months, but I only went in January and I hadn't been in it almost a year before that. So it's heartbreaking. What about you?
Yeah, no, I've got my three boys at home. So and we've been doing lots of homeschooling. It's been a nightmare. They're back to school now, which is much easier. So, we've managed, like a lot of, you know, like you have, you know, I managed to finish a record during lockdown, but you've done two albums during lockdown, haven't you?
Yes.
So the poetry one.
Yes, I know.
Incredibly powerful stuff, by the way, it must be said.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
And now a musical one. I mean, was that all recorded in lockdown?
No. I had the music album almost done, but had to mix it in lockdown, which was tough. Myself and Tim Brand were producing it together, and so normally we just sit in a room and work on that, and that's one of my favorite parts is mixing and editing and getting it all together, because I always over record anything that I need, you know. And I know It's like being in a sweet shop, isn't it? When you get to that bit, you think, oh, I know all the bits. Let's listen to them all again and figure out what's what and throw in some backing vocals here and there that might need it, or some weird noises that might need it to bump up the percussion. I often go in and do crazy sounds, all these little things to hide them in between. But that was hard mixing it because it just took much longer.
Something I did want to bring up anyway, which is something that runs through all of your records, is that they are so impeccably recorded and mixed.
And you produce on all of them. You've got a credit on all of them.
Yeah, I work on all of them. I just love it. It's part of what it's just part of the process, you know, from writing it all the way to the end. I see it all the way through. And I do love producing. I love the fun of it. It's fun. It's a lot of fun.
Because you know, it's that hardest bit. It's that hard. Is the end. Because I remember something that David Gilmour said to me once. He said, the thing is that, like, the first day you're in the studio, everything is brilliant. Everything sounds fantastic. So the key to a great album is, the hardest bit is, it's everything is down to that last 10%. Is that kind of 5 months in, it's managing to muster that same enthusiasm on sort of day 15 of mixing a song as you did on day one.
Mm. Yeah.
Which you clearly have.
And yes, I do. I do. I love it. And I get, it's just those, the last bits. And Tim and I worked really well on this. We're very similar in the way we work. And so it was lovely. We had a great friendship. And just those last bits is the bits that drive me mad. It's the very end when they say, can you sign off on this? And you go, hang on a second. And then I go right through the whole thing again. And then I'm calling saying, yeah, the drum on that second verse, just the snare drum, it needs to be taken down just like a half a dB and then bring it back up on the second. And they're like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, I'm so sorry.
There are things that no one will ever hear. But the trouble is with letting it go is that that's the finished version. That's it forever and ever. And there are other alternatives on any song, you know, and you do worry. I mean, all of us, I think, God, I think creativity comes out of stress it rather than anything that's positive.
Well, for me, I love it. I really enjoy it. And I'm very decisive when into the studio. I almost in a backwards way. I know what I don't want. I know what I don't want to hear. Because I've never studied music, so I don't write. I can't. Anybody around me has to be quite patient because I'll know what I don't want. So I'll listen to something being played and I'll say, give me loads of different versions. No, and it'll be a minor. No, not that, into the major. And I'll go, keep going. A different, not that. And I go, that's the one that I want. And I know what I don't want. And I do know what I do, which sounds quite basic, but it's that spark, if you know what I mean. It's that moment where it clicks. You go, that's exactly right. Or when I'm in doing backing vocals and stuff, I do tend to do backing vocals at the end because you can vibe off, and then also you can fill in what needs to be done that hasn't happened. And then sometimes I like that more because you can come up, you can be more creative with it because something needs to happen in a certain area, and instead of being something that you'd expect, you have to use your head to make it work with only, you know, sometimes it only your mouth. So I'll think, God, I remember one thing, and I wanted a sound of a breeze, and I didn't want any synthesizers, and I was listening to old Disney cartoons, you know, where they'd have all those really high pitched voices that would swoop in and down and around.
Yeah.
That's what I need in there. So I jump in and I make this breeze. And sometimes I try and make my voice sound like a string or even a
theremin. Theremin.
Yes. I've had a few people saying, oh, I love the theremin on that. It's me in the background.
But that's one of the things that's really changed with computer recording as it's got evolved, is that you can leave your decisions till later and later and later. You know what I mean? Is that you don't actually have to commit to anything until right at the last minute of the mix, you know, change the guitar amp, you know.
Even then, when you hear it back, like I'm listening to it now going, oh, I wouldn't have done that. just out.
what about when you release, because the way it's done now, you know, the album sort of lands and on whatever platform you're looking at, and there's only one track available. And you're thinking, the record company and you wanted that to be the single, but you feel like, maybe this doesn't fully represent my album though. And that's a bit tough, isn't it?
Oh, do you know what you've hit on a nerve there? That drives me mad because I'm not good with the business side of the music business. If I could not do that, I would love it. I love to write and sing and create and all that. And I find the business side really, really hard because you know that there's a bunch of people sitting around a table discussing what they think will work. And I don't think anybody really knows. I think
no, they don't. But by the way, they don't. It's all that they've been making it up for years.
I don't think, because when, as you know, when you go out on the road and you sing, the audience tells you what connects with them. I love if you do a little kind of secret preview of an album, and you can tell immediately what ones move people and connect. And I've done that before, where I'll say, this song is working really well at the gigs, and you have a bunch of people in a record company who often do have your best interests at heart. Like, they're often really lovely people thinking, we do believe in you as an artist, because I've been told we believe in you as an artist, and we want it to go well for us and for you. So it's not, I don't find it such a negative thing, but it comes from the wrong place, from a different place for me. It comes from business, not from art or heart. You know,
because in the old days, in the 70s, bands used to take their albums out on the road before they recorded them, didn't they, and get a vibe. I saw Pink Floyd at Wembley doing Wish You Were Here before they'd recorded Wish You Were Here, and it all changed after that.
Wow. See, that makes more sense. And then you can change and figure out what needs to happen, and then immediately you can tell what's a single and what's not. But I've had that before where things where they say, it should be this. You go, really? You sure? They go, well, 16, 32 people discussed it today.
And we all in a focus group, yeah.
Okay.
One of them is the head of Radio 2, and he wants this on the playlist. Oh, no, that's my least favourite track. You've got some amazing people on this album as well, haven't you? I mean, I was quite surprised to see, Gina Martin is singing.
Yes, Gina Martin and Dr. Shola Moshogbamimu.
I'm glad you said that. Thank you.
She's wonderful. The two wonderful women that I it was a International Women's Day a few years ago that I think it was Annie Lennox was hosting it, and it was held indoors. The weather was so bad. Normally it's out on a march, but it was indoors, and so everybody, it was, you could really hear what everyone was saying, and I brought my daughter, and it was just, there was loads of men and women in the audience, which was lovely. And these women were, they just knocked me off my feet listening to them. I was jumping up, rallying, you know, with Dr. Shola. She was fabulous. And Gina Martin, they talk sense. It's common sense, you know. For instance, Gina Martin changed the law. She actually changed the law. She was at a festival. A guy stuck a camera under her skirt, took a photograph and started showing it to her friends. She wrestled with him, grabbed the camera off him, ran to the security, handed to the security. The security said, that is disgraceful, whatever. And then the guy has gone mad looking for his camera back. Security man talks to someone on the phone, hands the camera back to the guy. And she said, what are you doing? And he said, apparently he's done nothing wrong. It's not against the law.
Wow.
So Gina Martin said, well, I'm going to change the law. And she did.
Yeah.
She went she has a book out now called Be the Change, and it's how to go about changing laws that need to be changed. And it's an incredible amount of work when you read it. Going in and out of Westminster, putting your case forward, and she had to hire a solicitor, and it took her over a year and a ton of money to do, but she did it. And I couldn't not fall in love with someone who can be that wonderful. And she's just like, I'm think she's brilliant. And Shola is the same. Shola is well versed. She's a barrister, I think, and she's fighting for human rights, for women's rights, for equality, for everybody. And her speeches are out of this world. You know, when I write, I love to take my time to get it right and go back and change it and fix it. She speaks like she's spent all day, you know, on that one page, you go, oh, the point she makes. So I asked them, will they join me on this song, Made to Love, that's about fighting for love and that it's worth fighting for, and that so many people have died for it, have died for fighting for love for all of us. So I named Martin Luther King and John Lennon and Marielle Franco, who was a wonderful Brazilian actress who was activist who was shot 4 times for just trying to improve the lives of other people. And I thought, do you know what? It is worth fighting for. It's that's the only thing really is love. That is all we have at the end of the day. When you're lying on your deathbed, what did you contribute to the world? If all you can say is love, I think that's the most beautiful thing. And so I asked them to join me on this song, and because I thought their voice is not just the voices, their singing voices, which were wonderful, by the way, their voices and what they contribute, I thought would work really well on the album for me personally. And it did.
The track is a bit of a stealth bomber, isn't it? Because you don't actually expect it to be about all the stuff that it is about at the end, you know? Yeah. You say, oh, here's another love song. And it's
and Ronnie plays on it as well. He was gone wild on it. Ronnie Wood, who I'm mad about. And the vibe in the studio was great.
I said the one time I actually performed with you with Ronnie Imelda, you wouldn't remember.
Where? I will remember. Tell me.
At the Roundhouse. It was a Roundhouse charity thing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Now she's lying. She just said that to please you.
No. I remember. No, I never lie. I say, I'll always say no. I don't know what you're talking about. But
sorry, I'm used to the humiliation. It's fine.
That was the first time that I had sang with Ronnie since when I met him when I was 16, and we jammed. That's how we met. Was he jumped up on stage?
That's right. He told that story, and
we jammed when I was a kid, and I was.
Where?
When we met again, I said
it was in Dublin, wasn't it?
It was in Dublin, and that's where I went to music school. Was in a basement, sticky floor club. It was a jam session every Monday night in a pub called Brussels, and amazing musicians went there on their night off just for the fun of it.
Where in Dublin is it?
Well, it was in Brussels pub, which I'm sure you know it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think where it is.
It's
Dublin.
Just by the Westbury, just off Grafton Street.
Oh, I definitely know it.
you do.
Yeah, I do.
And I think Ronnie was staying in the hotel next to it and just went out for a drink with his brother and then ended up hearing the music go down into the basement. And it was the two brothers who ran the pub put this night on. We always thought it was because Dave, the guy who owned it, and he was the worst. He was a terrible drummer, and the only way he could get a gig was to put on a club and be the drummer. I know what I'll do. I'll buy a pub and I'll put on a night and I'll be the drummer.
More power to him, frankly.
he was such a great guy, and that was the only stipulation, was he had to play drums. And so everybody came down. It was Van Morrison's band and Hot House Flowers. And
well, it was like, you've got to come down and check this drummer. He's awful.
So I want to know two songs. I want to know the song that you jammed with Ronnie on that he jumped up, and also what song you played with Guy.
Oh, great. Thanks.
Loudhouse. Right. There you go.
Pretty sure it was a 12 bar. It was two songs, actually. It was.
Yeah, go on.
I can't remember.
It was Rolling and Tumbling, because that's the song I remember doing with Ronnie. And
that's right.
And it was enough, because I was singing blues, and then that night at this charity do, it was Roland, and we said, let's just do it, and it was just a jam.
Because I don't think we rehearsed. I think it was just like, right, 12 bar and G or something.
Let's go for it, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was so much fun. And then there was a Etta James song we did together, can't remember.
This is a good opportunity, though, to just... to imagine you as, you know, beginning and setting out in Dublin and where you started. Because you grew up in the Liberties, didn't you? Which is quite a tough area. Or were you living in a big posh house in the middle of a tough area? Yeah, did you own
No, it was it was a tough area in that there was no money in the area. It just, without going to taking up too much of your time, it was Guinness's was the main factory in that area. I was brought up with the smell of Guinness, the hops brewing beside me. And what happened was that was all, like, almost overnight computerized. And the whole area was out of a job. all at the same time. The unemployment, it was just rife. I remember the suicide rates were up, drug problems were up, because families all went into Guinnesses. You know, people, because they used to take care of their workers. There was great healthcare and they had fitness and dentists and stuff. It was a really good job opportunity for whole families. So overnight, a whole family was out of a job.
What year?
That would have been late 70s, early 80s is when that all started. And so the place was already a working class area, and that was probably hanging on by its nails anyway. And then that just killed it. So it was tough in that way for everyone. But the community, I mean, I go on about being from the Liberties a lot because the community was amazing. They are,
it's an amazing name, even just the Liberties. It sounds like you're communards already. Just from being
but
there.
So the Pale Wall is just beside us, and beyond the Pale is actually about the Liberties. So it was under English rule, and people broke out from the Pale Wall and started up their own town beside it, and that was called the Liberties. So we're rebels from the word go.
All right, so you're Les Miserables, yeah.
Yes. So I have the fighting spirit in me all the way through, and my mom and my granny and my great granny were all from there. My mother was brought up in a tenement house, so it had really tough times. But the people are just magnificent,
and there must be music as well. Having spent a lot of time in Ireland myself, and music just is everywhere. It's what people do, isn't it?
It's constant. Everybody plays something. Everyone knows poetry and. Well, everybody will be a philosopher. It's like, go back to the ancient Greeks. Everybody will quote various things. We get into a cab even. But I remember, speaking of music, I remember I've told this before, but this JFK ship sailed up the Lithium. It was all over the news, and it was a big deal just because it was so huge. And so we were called in the local area that there was going to be this... I can't remember how old I was. I was only a kid. And we were called into the area that there was going to be in the local church hall a performance from the gospel choir from the JFK ship, the Navy. Wow. And so we all the locals gathered across from the church in this, the little flower hall. And we all sat down on the floor and all that. And then they sang and they were, it blew my mind and definitely influenced me. To hear this gospel sang. I'd never heard anything like it. And they were so brilliant. And then at the end of it, this woman stood forward and she said, I'm from the Bronx. And she said in New York, and she told us about her life and a few people didn't. And she said, I have to say, it was an absolute honor for me to come to sing for the underprivileged children of Dublin. We all looked around going, oh God, where are they?
Oh my God.
I love them. Where are they? It's us. So we never knew any of that. We've had a great time.
So your family, were you inspired musically by them? And
we had a two up, two down, and seven of us in it, one record player. So as you can imagine, the music was constant. We fight for the record player. And that couldn't have been a better education for me, because I heard everything from big bands and Nat King Cole and David Bowie and the Carpenters and Bing Crosby. And, you know, it was the Specials, Meatloaf. It was... because we were all different ages. So we all got to experience each other's music, which was just brilliant. I mean, you couldn't wish for more.
So you didn't really have a moment with music. It was just kind of always there. Was it something you loved from the get-go?
It was always in my life. And I was always a little bit of an entertainer. And my mother started up a local music and drama group for the kids in the area. And... I was in it, and we'd sing and dance doing old show tunes. And we used to go into local competitions all around it. It was so much fun.
Have you got a favourite show tune from back then?
Oh, God. My mum taught me it was one of my first songs my mother taught me, was Judy Garland. I'm always chasing rainbows, watching clouds drifting by. Do you remember that one?
Oh, your voice.
Yeah, I know. That's unbelievable. That is unbelievable. That's the voice. Best. That's the best thing that's ever happened on this podcast.
Are you sure you don't have an underprivileged person just to the side? Do you mind? I actually think you have an actually performer's quality to your singing, to your delivery. There is that in what you do, and certainly in your poetry reading.
I never thought. I go into myself when I'm singing. I go into I always feel like two things happen to me when I sing. I go right in and I feel everything stronger than ever. And then sometimes when it gets to that beautiful place, I feel like I just levitate a little off the ground. And I feel like I could, I go to the same place when I'm writing. It's like I lift up a little bit off the ground. And I mean, as normal humdrum things. And I feel like I can almost catch a cloud, you know?
Oh, that's a wonderful way of putting it, isn't it? But what about the rockabilly thing? Where did that?
I was going to say, yeah. When did you decide that's my thing?
Was that a Dublin scene or?
Not really. So, what happened to me when I was 16 and I went down to this club that my brothers and sisters went to all the time? I used to hang out with them and they used to bring me everywhere. And there was rockabillys there, but it was roots music, so it was a lot of blue, there was blues and jazz and soul and punk, and it was all it was just such a great evening, a great place. And when I was that teenager, that was the moment I got totally obsessed, and my brothers and sisters used to bring me there all the time and sneak me in. They'd say, oh, what's the weather like, and the bouncers would look up, you know, security, and then they'd walk me in and then look back again and say, so there was an understanding that they'd sneak me in because I'd be singing all night. And and that's, as I said, with Ronnie jumping up, but that definitely was the moment that clicked with me. And so I just got totally into that and I couldn't stop. It was something that I couldn't not do it. So I used to write all the keys up my arm and pen and go to open mic sessions and sit in the corner and hope to God somebody would ask me up. And then
I write the keys on your arm. What
key I sang certain songs in.
So you could tell the band.
So I could tell the band.
That's actually incredibly sort of professional, and that's brilliant. I've never heard of anyone doing that. That's brilliant.
And so I'd be waiting, thinking, because I never wanted to ask. So I wait for the moment where they'd say, anybody else want to sing? Because there was always the people up the front. And then I was terrified, but I had to do it. And my mom and dad were great. My dad used to drop me off. I remember when I got a little older, I was 17 or something, my dad would pick me up when he was on his way to work, because these clubs would go on till 5 and 6 in the morning. And he'd used to come and get me, and they were so lovely. But the rockabilly thing came from, I was gigging and doing all that, and then I got to a point where I got to be a professional musician in a band that was a swing band, 11-piece swing band. We toured all over the place. It was great. And I thought that's what I wanted to be. I thought I wanted to be a professional singer. And when I became that, I was severely disappointed because I found they weren't my songs and it wasn't the joy that I thought it was going to be. And I was writing quietly and nobody knew much. And then I thought, do you know what? I'm going to scrap it all and start again. And then I started with my old band and I was writing like mad and it was going well. And the rockabilly thing came in quite late in my life. And it was because I was listening to, I used to love the Cramps and the Ramones and all these bands that I heard them doing old rockabilly songs. And I remember hearing interviews with Mark Bolan and all that, saying he was an Eddie Cochran fan. I was thinking, this is a really important music. So because I got into punk, I wanted to know where it came from. So that's what led me to rockabilly. And my ex-husband was mad into it. So he was saying, if you want to know, I'm the man to tell you. And because he was so into it. When we met, I was the kind of roots blues music where he was. So I started going through his record collection. I was thinking, this is phenomenal. This is wild. I ended up later on working with Jeff Beck and singing with Robert Plant and all. And all of these people tell me that that's what they wanted to be. The Beatles used to say they wanted to be a rockabilly band. And then I remember going to the getting signed and they were saying, I got turned down from a couple of record companies. And they were saying, if you just get rid of the rockabilly, we'll take you on. Mm-hmm. And that sparked something in my head thinking,
the rebel.
Why would, it's the rebel in me, the Liberty girl. I thought, that's a red rag to a bull. And then I also thought, why would you want to get rid of a music that was so important? Why is that shunned when you know, jazz is cool, blues is cool? Why is rockabilly shunned when it, without it, we wouldn't have had, say, the Beatles or all these other, Led Zeppelin, all these other bands. So I thought, fuck it, that's what I'm doing. And I started to really delve into it. And I loved the rawness of it. I loved the energy of it. It was sexy. It was dangerous. You know, all the earlier stuff, early Jane Vincent stuff and all. I loved the madness of it.
You found an image for yourself as well.
Yeah, I just ran with it. I totally ran with it. And I was having such a great time. I ran with it. But then it kind of backfired on me because that was when I got my record deal. And then I got known as this rockabilly girl. I thought, oh, hang on a minute. And I loved what I was doing, but it got to a point as a writer that I hit a glass ceiling with it. I felt like I was reviving something that shouldn't have been forgotten. Like I felt I had a mission in the way that I was a massive fan of the Stray Cats and the Guana Bats, and I loved what they did. So once I did that, then I thought, hang on a second, I can't go any further with this. I've written as much as I can. I've done as much as I can do, and that's when I thought I just pulled the plug on everything, really.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's something about your the real musician thing that Guy was talking about earlier. There's something about that being your Irish connection, because you know, it's not a place that you imagine people are going to suddenly go, what I really need here is a synthesizer on a computer. You know, when you've got people playing real stringed instruments and banging drums all over the place. And rockabilly, in a way, everything you've ever done in your entire career has a connect, as all about real players, isn't it?
Well, also, yeah, because you have made probably the only rockabilly records ever that feature a baran, right?
Oh, yes, me baran, which I was playing last night.
I had a terrifying moment there, wondering, that is that how you say it?
That's not bad at all. Baron. That was not bad, yeah.
I love the Baron. I love it. I'd send you a message.
You never used to say it like that.
I love it. I love it more than you.
It doesn't matter. It's fine.
I sent you a message, didn't I, Imelda, when I saw you on Instagram playing your Baron the other day? Because I had the privilege to play with Donal Lunny. I did a record with him.
Oh, my God, yes. He's amazing. Genius.
And it's the most extraordinary thing, because I just thought, it's a drum. It's got no tuning on it. What are you going to do with that? And I mean, he played to this record that I was making. And then when we soloed it later, I couldn't believe it. There, he's playing G there. He's playing a C there. He's playing an F there. Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yes, because you use your left hand to push the skin in and out to change the tone of it. So, I mean, you can the one you can get ones that are tunable. just to loosen the skin for the right resonance. You know, if you're in a dry room, once you get it where the skin is movable on it, then you're in. You use your left hand, you push it in and out, and you totally change the tone of it while you're playing. It's a beautiful instrument.
Is that something you just picked up? Sorry to interrupt. You just picked up, or did you actually sort of learn?
When I was 18, I ran away to the west coast of Ireland with a boy, and I lived in a caravan for a year.
Oh, they're the stories we want to hear.
Yeah. Your life is just romance from beginning to end, isn't it?
And the film crew were in tow, and Ridley Scott was there. No, the truth is, your mum and dad must be going mental.
They didn't know I was with a boy. I lied.
Who did they think you were with?
I told them I was with my friends, and my mum and dad didn't have a phone, and I only went down for the weekend. And I remember ringing the neighbour, saying, could you run over to me, mum, and tell her I won't be home? I'm staying.
How does this got to do with the Bowron? What happened?
That's where I learned to play the Bowron. I did two things when I got there. I got myself a little job in a cafe, the only cafe in the village. There was a cafe, three pubs and a post office, and I got myself
so it goes to show the eating to drinking ratio of
well, the pubs in Ireland are certainly in that area. There's such a social structure that the food in them is so you go there to eat in the evening. You go to the cafe for your breakfast, whatever, but you go to eat in the pub in the evening, and then a session will start. So that's why I learned to play the Bowron, because I got myself enough money to buy a Bowron from my job during the day. And then you'd go down to the pub and you'd stay there all day, just surrounded by musicians. And I just watched and listened and learned and copied what they were doing. And that's how I learned to play the Bowron. It was a great time.
I have to tell you a story where Guy and I went to Galway, didn't we?
Yes.
Years ago, together, just because we're that kind of a couple, it looks like. But we weren't running away with each other. But we went to drink in a pub in Galway, and I forgot who was playing, this amazing Irish female accordion player.
Sharon Shannon.
Yes, Sharon Shannon. She was playing.
She's unbelievable.
Amazing. So we're sitting there drinking, and as it's getting towards the end of the evening, this little guy, Potman.
Oh, the pot, yes.
Who collects glasses. He's walking around and he's collecting all the pint glasses up. And he's got two massive stalks of glasses in each hand, you know, one in each hand. And it must have been about sort of 5 foot high. He was putting a glass right on the end. And then he gets in the middle and Sharon Shannon gets a reel going and he starts dancing. Doing Irish dance or a jiggle. It was hysterical. What a night that was.
That's right.
I once saw an old man with a big beard in a pub in the centre of Dublin come over while we were having a session, and he played a pint glass with a penny, and he stood there and he went ching 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 as he was drinking it, and the tone was a little bit wrong, so he took a big swig out of the pint, ching 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 ching. That was genius.
Because there's a thing, isn't there? There's a thing with Guinness that the proper pros do, isn't there? There's a thing of you tap your Guinness with a coin, and it's only when it gets to a certain tone that it's ready to drink.
Wow. Oh, I never heard that one. I'll be doing that.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Yeah, but you don't know what tone you're looking for.
I'll be sitting there tapping away before I have a sip.
You mentioned Jeff Beck. Yes. I saw you playing, actually. I think you came on stage at the Albert Hall. I think it was the Albert Hall I saw Jeff play at. How did that happen? I mean, and then that must have taken you into another musical world.
Oh my God. I love Jeff dearly. He's family, you know, I love him to bits. But I met Jeff through, well, it was kind of, I ended up working with Jeff through a crow.
What?
A crow.
What, literally, a crow?
Yes.
That was very good. That was actually very good.
Yes.
Was this being on later? Because I'm sure I saw you on, I think I was performing on later and you were on later, and Jeff Beck was there and he wanted to see the band you were with or something.
Yes, they asked, Jules said, who are you here to see? And I thought he was going to say Dave Gilmore, because Dave Gilmore was on the show. And yeah, he said, I'm here to see Imelda May. And I'm,
oh, you were there that night, like,
I was there.
Jaw dropped. It was unbelievable. So I was, I did a little gig in Sheffield. And when I say little gig, I mean little. You know, there was just a few people at it. And the owner of it took a chance on me because I'd been there with my swing band. So when I got my own band together, I said, you know, give us a job kind of thing. Do you have an afternoon free? And one of Jules Holland's agents or something was there and called Jules. So it came up that way, just naturally. And because I hadn't got a record deal or anything like that. I had no backing or no manager or anything. And Jules then asked me to open for him in Kew Gardens. So I opened for him. And then I got a whole bunch of dates to open him on tour. It was amazing. And I went on tour with Jules. And Jeff came to one of those gigs. He was there to see Jules. And Jeff was there. And but at the time, I had rescued a crow that I found under a bush in the local park.
Of course you had. And,
yes.
Underprivileged and, crow.
It hadn't got a feather on it, so it wasn't even a fledgling. And I hand-reared it until it was an adult. But at the time, I was still hand-feeding it. But it takes a month for them to get a good bit of strength in them, you know, whether you know whether they're going to make it or not. Because they're as much as they're hardy, they're actually quite, anything wild is very, very delicate. The balance of what they need is quite a delicate thing to get. And I don't think at the time I realised how hard it was to hand rear a crow, because I've rescued a couple since. They seem to come to me. I've rescued a couple since, and I one of them went back to the wild, and I lost another one. Because the mothers do such a great job.
You left it in a club or something.
Yeah. So, so anyway, to cut a long story short.
This is an amazing story.
Don't cut anything short.
It made me feel so good.
So I brought the crow around on tour with me on the Jules Holland tour, because I couldn't leave him at home. So I got a little cat box for when he needed to be, when I was on stage. And he sat, he was in the dressing room in the cat box. Then
did you have a rider? Did you have a rider for the crow?
Yeah. No. I had to feed it every couple of hours to keep it going, you know, through the night he'd be getting up feeding it and all. And then he thrived. He was doing really, he started to do really, really well. He used to sit getting warmth in under my leather jacket. I remember going into the gigs and he'd be hiding under my arm. And he was just a gorgeous little thing. And but I did want him to go back to the wild because he was healthy and well and very intelligent and very tender. They sit on your shoulder, sit on my shoulder and groom me and little chit chats in your ear. I just fell madly in love with him. And anyway, at this gig, it was Jeff's wife, Sandra, came over to me and she said, because it got to the point where the crow, I could fling it up into the tree and it would sit in the tree and wait for me, and I'd go and do it because it was outdoors. I could go and do the gig. And then afterwards, I'd call it and it would come down and fly back onto my arm and sit on my shoulder. And Jeff's wife, Sandra, came over and she said, did I see you with a crow? Do you have a crow? And I said, yeah, he was under my jacket having a little snooze. And I said, but I have a massive problem at the moment because we were chatting about it. She rescues animals. And I said, I'm having a problem because I don't know how to let him go. Because I lived in London and there was a lot of dogs around. I said, and he's attached to me. He needs to be near someone that he can come back to until he's confident. And she said, well, I rescue animals and I have an aviary and I have one that's just become free. Do you fancy coming to the house? And I'd be able to do just that, bring him to the, I'd keep him with me and I'm in the countryside and I can release him bit by bit. And I said, sure. So we ended up going back to Jeff and Sandra's house. Then we ended up staying for the weekend. Then we ended up having brandy coming out. And then me and Jeff were just sitting jamming and having great fun, drinking brandy. And then I started singing How High the, I think it was Somewhere there's music, I've faith to choose. Somewhere there's heaven, I'll hide the moon. You know that one. Yeah. There is no moon above when love is far away too. Do, 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 do. You know, anyway, so I start doing that and he start playing. And so he was doing all this brilliant stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he said, we should do that. We should do something with that. And then the next thing I know, we're off on tour around America doing the Les Paul and Mary Ford tribute.
That's an amazing story.
That's an incredible story. But I was thinking, because I'm just wondering about this idea of releasing the crow back into the wild, because it's one thing it being reared by humans, but this thing's been on tour.
Yes, I never thought about that.
It's hard enough.
What's to say, guys, you won't believe what I've seen.
I mean, I know what I'm like when I come back off tour, you know.
Yes, I never thought about it. He was on tour. And I remember when we were leaving.
Probably a total diva to all the other crows now.
I remember when I was leaving Jeff's house and I was crying in the car, just missing him, you know, knowing that he was going to be, Sandra was going
crow,
to
not Jeff.
And what?
That's the crow you were missing, not Jeff.
No, it was the crow. And I remember leaving the house and knowing that Sandra was going to release him beautifully, as she did. And I used to go down to visit the crow. And I remember as we were leaving crying and saying, I'm worried about it. I remember my ex-husband saying to him, laughing at me, saying, are you mad? He says, that aviary the crow is in is bigger than our fucking house. It'll be grand. He was in a beautiful big aviary. And he went back to the wild. And so that's the truth. That's the honest to God's truth of how I ended up playing with Jeff Beck.
That's amazing. But the crow was last seen touring with the Foo Fighters, I believe.
Black crows, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
The birds.
I know.
He's got a couple of tattoos and a leather jacket now. He doesn't want to know me. He's outgrown me.
Getting on to your developing career moment, then going on to work with T-Bone Burnett and dropping all of that rockabilly look in a way with Life, Love, Flesh and Blood. That seems to be just such a key part of your story, isn't it?
Oh, it's me awakening, you know? It feels like it's my... I had a big moment. I think I would say I definitely changed. You do, don't you? You know, life, as you get older, you change, yeah. You learn. And I think sometimes you have to realise the difference between compromising, which you do and you have to do, and it's good to do, between actually compromising everything. You know, there's that moment where you think, hang on, I'm totally watering my own self down to make everything be okay for me or everyone else. And it was that moment where I didn't feel like I was actually being myself almost all the time. Like, you know, it got to that where I was once upon a time, but I just got grown up a bit, you know, and me and my ex-husband too, we're best pals and I love him. We're family, you know, forever. And but we met when I think I was 22, you know, we've been together like 18 years. You do change, you either change with each other or apart. And we're lucky with the relationship that we have now because he's totally fab. And I actually popped in just this morning and we're good. But he saw, I suppose, in me as well, probably you see things. And I hit a bit of a rock bottom and I had to find my way back up again. And that's what I did. I got lost. I got totally lost. And I didn't know who I was because I'd compromised so much. I'd lost sight of who I actually was. So I had to hit rock bottom, I think, in order to relearn like a child again. And it was lovely. In the end, it turned out good, but I'm glad I did it. But musically, I remember that's why Life, Love, Flesh, Blood was so important to me because it was the first time that I'd written not knowing what I was going to write. I remember sitting down thinking, I'm not going to put any kind of box around me on this one. Where before I was felt like by the end of it, I was writing, I knew what I had to write. You know, this is going to be this type, but I'm going to do this. where it's I want to be led by, I don't want me to lead the song, I want the song to lead me.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's what I did. I sat down and kind of let it happen and be able to catch a cloud and not knowing what it was going to be and just write whatever that mood was that day. And it was very liberating, to be honest. There was lots of beauty in it. You know, you feel like you're patching yourself back together, song yeah. by song, moment by moment, with each thing that you'd learn. And I was very lucky that I got to do that, because some people never get to do that. They just keep strapping themselves up with bandages all over themselves to try and hold it together. I was lucky that I was able to let it go and then rebuild myself. And so I did that with music as well. And I'm very grateful to have those moments, because I feel really like myself, and musically as well. I feel I can do whatever I want, you know, and that's what I'm going to do forever. From, you know, I'm just going to do whatever I want, whether it works or not. That's not the point.
Because you were mentored, weren't you? You said by Bono. Was this around?
Well, he's lovely. He's always, yeah. he's there. I can't remember how we met. I think I asked him to sing with me. Oh yes, I did a gig. It was my first gig in the O2, in the Three Arena in Dublin. And it was a massive moment. All my family there. I think most of the audience were my family. I remember when they asked me for my guest list and they thought I was joking.
Crow plus four.
It was like, can we put, I've narrowed it down to 135.
The promoter must have loved you.
So it was gorgeous. And then I got a message from Bono. Oh yes, he sent a beautiful black velvet champagne and Guinness. And I was doing a couple of nights and I asked, would you join me? And he said, sure. Turned up and we did this duet. We had a great time and we just stayed in touch ever since. And he's just, so as you know, sometimes musically, I think everybody needs somebody to tell them the truth. And it's hard to get that sometimes. Not that people kiss your ass. It just, sometimes people will like what you've done or maybe won't, will listen to it rather than pick it, you know? And sometimes when you get stuck, it's hard to know what to do or who to call. And you're too close to it. You need somebody who can't hear it. And Bono is always there in that way for me. Like, say Made to Love, I was throwing that song out. I was getting rid of it because I kept working on it. And it just wasn't, there was something not working with it. And I kept trying it and pulling it apart. And Tim Brown was brilliant. And David Rossi was great. We wrote together. And so we knew it was a good song because we'd written it. David had done all the strings and Tim was doing all the music. And then I do all the lyrics and the melody. So we're a good team. So we knew it was there, you know, in the song. We knew the heart of it was great. But when it came to getting it right, it was me and Tim sitting in the room and I was going, it's not working in that area for me. It's like 90%. I can't get that 10% right. And kept chopping and changing. And that's where Bono comes in for me. I'll say, do you have a minute? Can I just send you this? Because I'm really stuck and I'm about to throw it out. And the same happened on the last album with How Bad Can a Good Girl Be? I was going, he was like, keep going. You're almost there. Because you want somebody to say, am I wasting my time? Basically, that's all. Mm-hmm. So I just said, will I throw this out or will I keep on at this? Am I flogging a dead horse? And he said, you're not flogging a dead horse. Keep going on it. Maybe, because I was saying, the title was Don't Be Afraid to Love. So I had a negative kind of a connotation with a positive chord.
Yeah.
So why don't you flip it around? Why don't you do a negative chord with a positive connotation? You know, so I did Made to Love and I flipped the chords around a little. And then all of a sudden it just clicked.
And is that how he worked with you on Life, Love, Flesh, Blood? Was he there on the phone? He wasn't in the room with T-Bone Burnett, sort of.
No. He like when you're doing stories of people, they use that in the newspapers that he's there guiding it and all that. He's not. Mm. He'll send me a message. He see I'm struggling and say, "Keep going. You're on the right track. Keep going." And he's just very encouraging in that way. You're doing the right thing. When I wrote a poem called You Don't Get to Be Racist and Irish. And I got a lot of shit from that. I was getting death threats.
Did you? Bono, wow.
Yeah, because from the far right, because I said you don't have to be racist and Irish. Then people thought I was anti-Irish, and
it's a brilliant.
So I got a lot of.
Yeah, it's a fantastic poem.
Oh, and so Bono would just say, "Keep going, you're on the right road with it." And he sent me a little message, or you know, I remember a long time ago. This is the kind of lovely, thoughtful man he is, and we're not chatting all the time at all, but he's just a support. He comes from art always and kindness. And I think that's always a good person to have in your life. Somebody comes from art and kindness. And I remember writing and I was having a tough time personally and creatively. It was when I was changing everything. And he texted me, said, "Are you okay? You know, heard something in the paper." And I said, "I'm grand. I'm writing this song, I'm stuck." And he said, "Write it." And I said, "Well, I haven't got a guitar or anything like that. I'm a shit guitarist, by the way, but I was working it out." And I said, I've nothing to work with. It's okay. I'm just going to forget about it. Little while later, there's a knock on the door and a guy standing there with a guitar, a rental guitar. "This is arrived for you." And there's a note on it. And it says, "Write the fucking song." And so I did.
Wow.
Oh my God.
You know, it's just a lovely support that I don't lean on often, but I know it's nice to have him there because he's a good reference for.
Also very handy for instrument rental, clearly.
yeah. He's very thoughtful.
Poetry is really important to you, isn't it?
Oh my God, I write poetry more than songs. Yeah, daily, if I could, if I didn't have to clean the kitchen and, you know, do all those normal cooking and cleaning for.
There's a mad one on there about masturbation as well, isn't there? That's.
Yes. Yes.
I was playing, please.
It's called, do you know, it's one of the few that I know by heart because all my girlfriends get it to say, you know, that's the, when we're out with a bunch of margaritas, they make me stand on the table and say this. Well, this is the girls' anthem. Yes, it's called GBH. I'll try and remember. "Grievous battery harm replaces previous flattery and charm for readers' wives whose daily lives are beyond the hum of the drum of the washing machine and routine. And so sit and scream at their other halves for sitting in front of a screen instead of rolling in a bed with them. YouTube, you porn, KY, new norm, couple solo love with sock gloves and do not disturb on the door down the hall from each other. So batteries acquired to extinguish hot desires. Unsatisfied, ungratified from the bloke who for a while now is umbilically tied to the strings of his the wife stroke mother of the child who he never strokes as much as the chicken that he chokes on his own down the hall with his Tinder kinder. So empowered from her summer in Siam Shazam and the summer that is Anne and the stories Victoria gave her wings and things that could save her more than any bull she's labored over celebrates over and over and over, 9 times in a row and counting. Our wrists get tired, our little rampant boy expires, more batteries required for her waterproof, warm silver bullets and joys, glittery gliding silicone toys, all our wants, wills, filled, thrilled. No man's tongue will ever hit that spot again. As she rides on the vibrations and the waves of sweet Jesus sensations as she grievous battery harms herself all the way to heaven.
Oh, that was amazing. There's also a brilliantly pro thing when you actually lifted the phone up to get your arm at the end.
Oh, did I?
Yeah. Oh, that was
incredible. Incredible.
You should be Poet Laureate of Ireland very soon, I would have thought, with a tune like that, with a poem like that. I mean, Melda, I think this is probably, like, we can't do better than this now.
Yeah, exactly.
It's time to say thank you, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much for asking me to be on this. You're just wonderful, and all that you give to everybody, all your art and creativity, and you just contribute so much to the world. Thank you.
We're all trying to do our bit in lockdowns.
You've been an absolute inspiration, must say, Melda. Talk to you. Brilliant. You made the world
so
a better place.
To talk to you too. And thanks a million for having me this morning.
Good luck with the new album. When's it out?
April the 23rd. Oh, no, it's moved forward to 18th. It's moved forward to April 16th.
April 16th.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
All right.
We look forward to all interacting in the real world again. Seeing you up there singing.
God. I'd love to give you a big hug next time I see you.
That was so enjoyable, wasn't it?
That was amazing. That was the first, I don't know if it was actually the first, but certainly by far the best musical performance we've ever had on this show.
Without a doubt. And poetry performance.
And it was like a full, it was like the best evening in an Irish pub, you could imagine. There was poetry, there was stories.
She's got such a massive...
And a rather unfortunate fight, but...
But you really get the sense of her having a big heart. She's got a
huge,
lot of
huge
capacity to love, and I'm going to go and play her record.
Yeah, so am I.
So thank you for listening, and we're going to have someone else coming into our boudoirs next.
A virtual boudoir.
But until then, leave a comment if you love us and put it underneath any of your podcast platforms. Is that what people have to do, isn't it, guys?
Yeah, do that. Well, subscribe. That's the most important thing. Subscribe!
And we'll see you next week. And so it's good night from me.
And it's good night from them.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.